from VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, what is happening with voting rights in the United States? In the wake of the 2020 U.S. election, approximately two dozen Republican-led states have either proposed or passed restrictive voting laws. Many of these state legislatures argue that they are simply trying to prevent voter fraud, but critics say their true motive is to suppress voter turnout among minority communities, particularly African Americans who tend to vote for Democrats. Our guest on this edition of the program will help us discern what is really going on with voting rights in America. Eliza Swearin-Becker is counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. That's an independent, nonpartisan law and policy organization with offices in Washington and New York. According to the Brennan Center website, Eliza Swearin-Becker focuses on voting rights and elections. Prior to joining the center, she was a litigation associate in private practice. She was also a Ford Foundation Fellow on the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project for the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU. The Brennan Center and many other voting rights advocates are concerned that the spate of restrictive voting laws being passed or upheld by the Supreme Court could undermine the 1965 landmark Voting Rights Act, which outlawed the discriminatory voting practices adopted in many southern states after the Civil War, including literacy tests as a prerequisite to voting. In recent days, the U.S. Supreme Court has removed much of the law's power. According to Dan Balls of the Washington Post, it gutted Section 5 in 2013, which required states with a history of discrimination to seek clearance from the Justice Department before making any changes in election procedures. And then on July 1, 2021, in a ruling that upheld Arizona's restrictive voting law, which limited the potential for successfully challenging voting changes after they have been enacted under Section 2. We will also look at the Justice Department's decision to sue the state of Georgia over its new voting law. Attorney General Merrick Garland alleges that the new law is intended to restrict ballot access to black voters. Democrats introduced the John Lewis Voting Rights Act in 2019, which passed the House of Representatives but died in the Senate Judiciary Committee. In the 117th Congress, many Democrats have pressed for the passage of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act of 2021, but have encountered opposition from members looking for bipartisan compromise. Eliza Swearin-Becker, counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, joins us via Skype to discuss it all. Eliza Swearin-Becker, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Sydney Sherry.
Hi, Carol. Thank you.
So, Eliza, let's start with your overall assessment of what's underneath, in your view, this plethora of restrictive voting laws that we're seeing emanating from mostly Republican-led states. Do you think they're seizing on false claims of election fraud in the 2020 presidential election?
Yes, what we've seen is a very stark reaction from state houses across the country responding to the historic voter turnout that we saw in the United States last year, and also to the lies about voter fraud and election irregularities that have continued to be advanced by the former president and others, and seizing on those misrepresentations to introduce and pass bills that they say are targeted at election integrity, but what they're really aiming to do is make it harder for Americans to vote.
So, Eliza, that begs the question, why would they want to make it harder for Americans to vote? After all, that is the underpinning of our democracy.
That's a great question. And I think you point to the fundamental undemocratic nature of these efforts. But what we're seeing is that some state lawmakers would rather try to ensure their job security by making it harder for certain populations of the electorate to vote, instead of going out and winning new votes and convincing people to vote for them. They're just trying to narrow the scope of the electorate as a means of gaining a partisan advantage and maintaining their power in office.
Just for some background, Eliza, I wonder if you could tell us from your research at the Brennan Center, you know, to what extent voter fraud actually does occur in this country. We heard from the chief election monitor that the 2020 election was one of the safest and even fairest elections ever, despite COVID-19 restrictions and a disproportional number of mail-in ballots.
That's right. The Department of Homeland Security said last year's election was the most secure election in American history. And voter fraud in the United States is vanishingly rare. It has not affected any outcomes of last year's elections. And the, frankly, conspiracy theories about election irregularities have been debunked time and time again. So these allegations about voter fraud and election irregularity are just flat out lies, and they're used as a pretext to justify these policies that make it harder to vote.
Let's take a look at the lawsuit that the Justice Department Attorney General Merrick Garland has announced against the recent Georgia law, their so-called Election Integrity Act. It supposedly makes sweeping changes to the state's absentee voting rules. It adds new voter identification mandates and nearly cuts in half the amount of time for voters to request a mail-in ballot. There are a number of other provisions that the DOJ is opposed to. It says that the law is in place, as you alluded to earlier, due to the large Black turnout in the 2020 election, which most likely swung the election for now President Biden, as well as the two senators who gave the Democrats the majority in the Senate. How do you see this lawsuit? Do you think it's justified? And to what extent do you think it may be eventually successful in trying to strike down this voter law?
The Department of Justice brought this lawsuit in Georgia after several other private groups and individuals also brought lawsuits in Georgia challenging the same law, SB 202, that was enacted earlier this year. And it's truly an omnibus voter suppression law that does a number of the things that you articulated. And I think one of the important things that the lawsuit by the Department of Justice signals is that the Department of Justice is back in the business of protecting voters, which is part of its mandate and what it should have been doing all along. So it's wonderful to see the department recommitted to protecting voters and voting rights. The lawsuit itself alleges that the provision intentionally discriminates against Black voters and makes it harder for them to access their voting rights and the ballot box. What we have seen, however, over the last week is a new U.S. Supreme Court decision that makes it harder generally to sue under the Voting Rights Act, which is one of the provisions that the Department of Justice sued under here. So it remains to be seen how successful the Department of Justice will be. I think certainly they have strong claims, but it will continue to play out in federal courts as the year continues.
I'm glad you brought out the recent Supreme Court ruling upholding an Arizona law, which many allege restricts voting rights. On July 1, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 6-3 in favor of Arizona's voting restrictions. Of course, the three more liberal justices voting against the decision. Why is this so significant in your view, especially with regard to the Georgia lawsuit? Many critics of this ruling are saying that this could make it even more challenging for not just the Justice Department, but others, as you said, who have brought lawsuits against state restrictive voting laws to be successful.
Well, you're absolutely right that this decision made it harder to bring lawsuits under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act by making it harder to establish that there was discrimination. And this decision comes against two very important backdrops, at least two. The first is a 2013 decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, Shelby County versus Holder, that essentially eviscerated the pre-clearance regime that was part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 4 and Section 5. The Supreme Court said in 2013 that the formula for determining which states had to get pre-approval for their new voting policies was too old. And so the Supreme Court invalidated that formula. And the pre-clearance regime, that pre-approval process, had stopped many, many discriminatory laws from being put in place in the first instance. So now we've lost that pre-clearance regime as of 2013. The other major tool available under the Voting Rights Act was Section 2, this provision that allowed private actors to bring lawsuits alleging that a voting law discriminated against different groups. By undermining the strength of Section 2, The Supreme Court has taken away that other second major tool for preventing voting discrimination. And they have done so at a time when that tool is urgently needed. As you said, there are a number of lawsuits already underway challenging some of the new restrictive voting laws that have been enacted this year. And the Brennan Center is tracking at least 28 laws in 17 states that have provisions that restrict voting access that were enacted just this year. We are encountering a flood of voter suppression from states across the country. Never has the Voting Rights Act been more important. Never has Section 2 been more important. And this is the very moment where the Supreme Court decided to weaken that provision and make it harder to attack these discriminatory voting laws.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Our guest is Eliza Swearenbecker, specialist in voting rights and counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice in New York. I'm Carol Castiel, along with intern and assistant producer Sydney Sherry. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. You can also check out our new page, Current Affairs at VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a very loyal listener and Facebook fan, Pastor Dr. Ulasi Caleb from Nigeria, where he runs a private school with his wife. He wrote us recently that although COVID-19 posed a very big challenge to the school, that they are excited that the school has resumed classes. Thanks so much for your news, Dr. Caleb. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Eliza Swearenbecker from the Brennan Center for Justice in New York. And now I'd like to toss it to my colleague, Sydney Sherry, for a question.
Eliza, in the wake of the Arizona voting restrictions Supreme Court case, do you predict that even more laws will be passed or proposed by Republican state legislatures?
Well, we are already seeing a massive surge of restrictive voting laws introduced primarily by Republican state legislators and passed on party line or near party line votes. So we are already in the midst of a surge of restrictive voting laws that will have discriminatory effects on the populations in the various states where these laws are being enacted. It's hard to imagine that that surge could get even greater after the Brnovich decision from the Supreme Court, but it's certainly possible that state lawmakers will see this as a green light to discriminate even further against the various minority populations in their states.
Eliza, speaking of the Arizona law, I wonder if we could get just a little bit granular and enlighten our audience about specific provisions that were upheld and why it's important that, especially for those advocating greater access to the ballot, for these types of provisions not to exist. You know, you said that they were enacted and that they are really undermining the Section 2. So talk about Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act a little bit more and the concept of ballot harvesting and other provisions in this Arizona law, which are anathema to voting rights advocates.
So the U.S. Supreme Court upheld two of Arizona's voting laws. One of the laws said that somebody who cast a ballot in the wrong precinct would have their entire ballot thrown out and not counted, even if the person was eligible for some of the races on the ballot, like president or governor, where the precinct isn't a factor in determining whether that person has the right to vote in those races. The other measure that the Supreme Court upheld restricted the circumstances under which a mail ballot could be turned in on behalf of somebody who is not a family member. So that second provision goes to what some people call ballot harvesting, but what is really just known as voter assistance. There are many people who need assistance in returning their mail ballots for one reason or another, whether they are elderly, whether they do not have access to public transportation, whether they are voters with disabilities. There are lots of reasons that voters need and should be able to obtain assistance in order to cast their ballots. And in particular, this anti-voter assistance measure that was upheld by the Supreme Court discriminated against Native populations in Arizona that live far away from the nearest voting office or accessible mailbox, for example. So these provisions discriminated against various populations in Arizona, Native populations and also Black and Latino populations. That's what the Ninth Circuit found before the Supreme Court decision. But the Supreme Court decision in Brnovich undermined Section 2 by essentially rewriting the standard that a plaintiff would need to satisfy in order to establish discrimination. And the court did harm in a number of ways, including by saying that essentially a little bit of discrimination is okay because our social conditions in the United States are such that there's no way to avoid discrimination. So the court essentially sanctioned some degree of discrimination in voting, which, as you said, is really anathema to voting rights and equal access to the ballot. The court also made it harder to bring a lawsuit under Section 2 as well, by pointing to voting practices from 1982 as the benchmark for determining whether something is discriminatory. So if a state has early voting, for example, now, and didn't have early voting back in 1982, the court is suggesting that that state could discriminate in some other method of voting because there is this early voting method instead. So it allows for discrimination in certain methods of voting if there are other practices in the state that aren't discriminatory. But of course, discriminating in mail voting is very meaningful to the people and the populations who need mail voting and wouldn't be able to access early voting because, for example, they live on a reservation with limited transportation that's far away from early voting polling places. So those are a couple of the ways that this opinion did harm to the ability of individuals to bring cases under Section 2.
Certainly, what you're underscoring is what, as you alluded to earlier, and many other voting rights advocates are saying, is really an evisceration or a gutting of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So I guess that brings me to ask you, what is the remedy? We're looking at Congress that has tried to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Of course, there's a much more expansive bill called S1 for the People Act, which doesn't look like it's going anywhere, not only because many Republicans are opposed to it, but even some more conservative Democrats. So what are the prospects, in your view, for Congress to remedy the damage that has been done, according to many, including your center, to the Voting Rights Act?
Well, I think the ball is in Congress's court, as you say, and there are a couple of bills that are at play. The first is the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which would strengthen the Voting Rights Act in part by restoring the preclearance regime and putting in place other additional measures to make sure that voters don't face discrimination at the ballot box. And that's expected to be reintroduced again this year in the House in a number of months. The other is, as you said, S1, or the For the People Act, which has already passed the House. Thus far, debate on that bill has been stymied by Republicans in the Senate, but it is absolutely still at play. And I think this decision from the Supreme Court really underscores the need for the Senate to pass the For the People Act, which, as you said, is a more comprehensive democracy reform bill that would implement a number of voter modernization policies that are already in place successfully in states across the country, and policies that are extraordinarily popular in states across the country, like early voting, same-day registration, automatic voter registration, universal access to mail voting. These are policies that states red and blue have been implementing for many, many years with great success. Policies that voters like because they give them the convenience to vote at the time and the place and in the manner that works for that particular voter.
So, Eliza, how optimistic are you that at least the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act might get enough votes to pass, given the political landscape? It's hard to believe that there will be any Republican votes. And of course, we have to deal with what we call in our system the filibuster, which is a 60-vote threshold in order to spark debate and then vote. How do you see this going forward with these obstacles?
I think there's still a very real shot that we can pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the For the People Act in this country. And that's because these are policies that Americans broadly support. And it's worth noting that the filibuster is a parliamentary rule. It is not a strict rule of Congress that cannot be changed. So I think that it's incredibly important for Americans to make their voices heard to their senators, to do whatever it takes to pass these policies. because they're absolutely necessary, both in the face of the undermining of the Voting Rights Act by the Supreme Court and in the slew of voting restrictions that are being enacted across the country. All of those things underscore the urgency for passing these bills. And I think and hope that our representatives will get the message that we need to protect American voters, and we need to do so now.
So, Eliza, assuming one or both of these bills passes, let's say the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, will that then supersede the Supreme Court decision upholding the Arizona law? What would be the impact on these state laws that are restricting voting access?
So the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, at least as it was introduced and passed in the House in 2019, did not directly address the standard that is set forth in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is what was undermined by this recent Supreme Court decision. So it's possible that Congress may undertake additional efforts to remedy the harms that the Supreme Court just imposed last week. But going forward, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act would re-implement the preclearance regime, which requires states and localities with a history of voting discrimination to get pre-approval for their voting policies to ensure that those policies don't discriminate against voters. If the preclearance regime is re-implemented, that would apply in a future-looking way, and it would not apply to the laws that were just passed over the last several months.
And I'd like to ask you about a particular provision that may be part of many of these restrictive voting laws in Republican-led states that concerns many, many people, Democrats and perhaps others alike, independents. And that is changes that could strip local officials of their powers and replace election administrators with partisan lawmakers. Talk a bit about that and the implications of that.
Well, one of the trends that we have seen from state legislatures this year is an effort to go after local election officials who were in many ways the heroes of last year's elections. Local election officials conducted elections in the midst of a pandemic under the most challenging and unprecedented circumstances. And they found ways to make sure that citizens could vote and access their right to vote safely and successfully last year. And in response, it's bewildering, but what we're seeing are state lawmakers trying to punish those very same local election officials that ensured the success of our democracy by creating new criminal penalties for inadvertent mistakes, by taking away the discretion that those local officials had and which they used in order to make sure that people could exercise their right to vote, and taking power away from those local officials and putting them in more political partisan bodies. So in the abstract, the question of who controls how elections are run is not necessarily one that bears on voting access. But in the context of what we saw last year, where local election officials used their discretion in order to ensure that Americans could access their right to vote, these policies that are shifting power away from those local officials seem intended to make it harder for Americans to vote.
Let me turn to Sydney. Do you have another question?
Yes. So critics of the larger national legislation like the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Advancement Act have said that it would federalize and take too much power away from the states to decide their own voting laws. What would you respond to that?
The United States election system is unique because states and the federal government both have authority over federal elections. The U.S. Constitution says that states can write the rules for the times, places, and manner of federal elections. So it gives states affirmatively that authority. But in the very same provision of the Constitution, it says that Congress shall have the power to make or alter those rules, effectively giving Congress veto power or superseding authority to create rules for federal elections. And that's because the framers who wrote the Constitution didn't trust state lawmakers. They were worried that state lawmakers were going to be ruled by partisanship and were going to take actions that would make it harder and more inconvenient for Americans to vote. So precisely because of this distrust in state lawmakers, the framers preserved power over federal elections in the Congress. The system that we designed is to make sure that the federal government could protect voting rights in precisely these instances or state lawmakers are making it harder for Americans to vote. So I would say to critics who are arguing for state authority over elections that states are entitled to make rules as to federal elections, so long as they aren't making it harder for Americans to vote. And the Congress has plenary total authority to make or alter those rules when it sees fit under any circumstances. And so that's precisely the system that we've designed in order to ensure that circumstances like these don't undermine voting rights.
Speaking of which, you know, I think this whole debate over voting rights, access, and so forth, you know, reflects the larger political polarization we see in this country, because we're seeing these restrictive voting laws emanating from primarily Republican states, and particularly in the wake of former President Trump's loss. He keeps perpetuating what many are calling this so-called big lie, whereby he says, "I still won," when he did not. Then the Republicans are saying that the Democrats are trying to grab power by trying to pass the For the People Act. So which is it? Which side is politicizing things? The Republicans, Democrats say, and other critics are passing these restrictive laws because they can't really attract too many to their side other than white males or a very narrow portion of the electorate. And therefore, they have to restrict blacks and others from voting, because if they are given the opportunity to vote easily, then they're sure to lose. How do you see it?
Well, there's nothing partisan about ensuring that all Americans can access their right to vote. And if there is a party that fears enabling all Americans from accessing their right to vote, then I think they need to look at the policies that they are espousing and try to win over more Americans and persuade them to vote for their particular party. One of the things that was really telling in the oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court in that Brnovich case, the Arizona case, was the lawyer for the RNC was asked, why is it important that these provisions of Arizona law be upheld? And she essentially said, the reason that we need these provisions is otherwise Republicans won't win in the state of Arizona. Essentially saying that policies that make it easier to vote for Americans are bad for Republicans because they are worried that the demographics of the country will make it harder for them to win elections. So I think what we're seeing really is a partisan effort to restrict the right to vote, to try to ensure power remains in certain partisan officials, whereas the effort to make it easier for Americans to vote is by definition not partisan because it benefits all Americans. Every American is benefited by automatic voter registration, early voting, mail voting. These are policies that apply regardless of party, regardless of race. And that should be something that every politician supports because it is something that strengthens our democratic process.
And as we close, Eliza, are you concerned about the strength of American democracy as a result of these voter restriction laws? And if those who are advocating for greater access to the ballot and greater voting rights, if they are not successful, that our democracy will truly be undermined? How concerned are you?
Well, I'm very concerned about these efforts to undermine our democracy. And I think one of the intentions of these voting restrictions is not just to make it harder for Americans to vote, although that's certainly an intention, but it's also to undercut and discourage people from participating. And so it's essential the country don't give in to that cynical effort to discourage them from participating. I think that we will be able to overcome these voter suppression efforts through fights in court, through actions in Congress, and by the democratic participation and engagement of citizens across the country. So I'm absolutely concerned. I think we're at a critical and very dangerous moment, but I also have optimism because I know that there are policies that actually we can put in place to make a difference, to make these problems better, and because I have faith in the American people who really treasure their right to vote and are not going to give it up so easily.
Eliza Swearingbecker is counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Eliza, thank you so much for your wonderful insights.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program was intern and assistant producer Sydney Sherry. Please join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.